from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. And now I'm going to talk about what's been happening in the news. It's tough to focus on everything else because of all the things that are happening in the Middle East, certainly with Iran and all the countries in the Middle East going essentially in a state of conflict with Iran. But with that, I'm going to talk about something that's been burbling up. You may have seen that DHS Secretary Kristi Noem was recently reassigned. Some use the term fired from her DHS secretarial position or secretariat. And she's been moved to something called Special Envoy or Envoy for the Shield of the Americas. And then President Trump went down to Miami and he had a big conference and talked about a lot of things that I'm going to talk about today. But first, I'm going to talk about Cuba. And Cuba, just for those who are kind of need to orient themselves, it's located about 90 miles south or 90 miles from Key West, Florida. It's in the, obviously, it's in the Caribbean. And it has been a, since 1959, certainly, when Fidel Castro came to power, it has been a thorn in the side of not just this president, but basically seven generations of presidents, Democrats, Republicans alike. In fact, when we talk about whether or not this is a partisan issue, it probably haunted no one more than John F. Kennedy, who was a Democrat, who was in office when the Bay of Pigs happened, and that was a huge military debacle for his administration. So many presidents over the last seven decades have tried one way or another to bring about an end to the communist regime in Cuba. And there have always been great hopes. President Obama opened up, you know, kind of did an opening of a U.S. relations with Cuba. You know, we have an embassy in Havana, and there was some tourism that took place and a little bit more than that. And I should also mention that Secretary of State Marco Rubio's family came from Cuba, and he and his family are staunch anti-communists who absolutely detested the Castro regime. And with all of that said, let me kind of bring it up. Cuba has been crippled by losing access to Venezuela's oil. And it's difficult to put into words. President Trump has tried many times to articulate just how bad the Cuban economy is. But it is. Cuba doesn't produce a lot and tries to sell what it can because of its kind of unique status. It doesn't have access to all the markets that other countries might have for some of the things. Obviously, difficulty dealing with its northern neighbor, the United States, but it has difficulty dealing with a bunch of neighbors around the world. And it was in an enormous economic crisis even before Maduro was taken by the U.S. from Venezuela. And now that lifeline that Maduro assured, that oil that was coming in to keep Cuba going, has been cut off by the United States. Now, Russia has been a staunch ally of Cuba. That goes back to the Soviet Union. In fact, Cuba was one of the great success stories of the communist revolutions of the Soviet Union when they backed Fidel Castro and they basically rode to victory and took Havana and kicked out all the Americans. And of course, that's kind of the history of why the U.S. has such a difficult relationship with them. But with that said, there's only so much they can do. Russia is completely tied up with this war in Ukraine. Is coming close to, I think Russian troop losses, killed, wounded, are coming close. They're going to someday soon, will be close to about 1.3 million. It's unbelievable losses that they're taking. It's costing them a phenomenal amount of money, and they just don't have the ability or the resources to really extend much support, substantial support, to Cuba. So there's nothing there. They have a relationship with China, but even China is very restrained and curtailed from being able to project much of anything to help Cuba out. Reports from Cuba are pretty dire. The power is down for 20 hours a day. That's right, 20 hours a day. 24 total hours in a day. They're out of power for 20 hours a day. 90% of the households now live in what's termed extreme poverty. So much for the communist socialist dream. It is a dirt poor country that can't keep the lights on. Now, a number of major hurricanes have blown across Cuba in recent years, depending on how you define recent years. The difference is that whereas other countries get international aid, they marshal resources, people come in and rebuild, that doesn't happen in Cuba. When the devastation left in the wake of that that hurricane happens, that relatively short-term disaster becomes a long-term disaster of epic proportions because they just don't have the resources to rebuild. And so in many cases, homes remain permanently damaged. Villages may never be rebuilt. It is just accumulated over time with every new. In many cases, one hurricane will go right over the same path that another hurricane did a few years before. And it, of course, for the Cuban people, they see a high degree of ineptitude and inability of the government, which is pretty much responsible for everything, to take care of them. It couldn't protect them before the hurricane hit, and it can't help them get back to normal after the hurricane left. In a totalitarian system like Cuba's, despite having a relatively small, nascent private sector, people are truly reliant on the government to provide them just about everything. And the government is having a tough time, some would say, providing just about anything. So that's Cuba. So President Trump on Monday, March 9th, revealed that Secretary of State Marco Rubio, I didn't really think it was a secret because I'd seen many reports that we were negotiating with Cuba or we're trying to negotiate with Cuba, that he has been negotiating with Cuban leaders and that there may be a major U.S.-Cuba economic agreement that could be announced very soon. And this could ease some of the economic restrictions, but that easing of restrictions won't be without some sort of commensurate things from Cuba, and we'll see what those look like. It's really not clear what exactly it is, but it's reported that the deal would allow Cuba's current president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, and his family, and maybe members of his administration, to remain in Cuba. I don't know what the plan was there, if they were going to take them somewhere else or have them leave the country. And it's not even clear if he would be removed from office. He may actually stay as president. He just has to stay as president working with the United States, which is a big change. Although Delcy Rodriguez down in Venezuela seems to have adapted fairly well to that. Now, Cuba's population has been declining along with the economy. So they're seeing demographic decline, significant demographic declines, and that's probably due to many factors, not the least of which is extreme poverty and the hardship of modern life in Cuba. But they have a lot of problems going on. If you look at what was done with Venezuela, that might be kind of a model, I think, for what we're thinking about or seeing with Cuba. In the wake of Maduro being seized, in the wake of the U.S. demonstration of its military prowess there, and basically putting an arrow through the heart of whatever the Venezuelan regime's vision was of invincibility, that rather than force the Delcy Rodriguez government, the Chavista remnant regime, if you will, out of power, which would have been very difficult because we don't have boots on the ground. We don't have the military forces to force them out. And that certainly would have sparked, obviously, a pretty big civil war in Venezuela. We chose another path. And that path was to work with the remaining government and to use our military situation, particularly our Navy and the de facto blockade of what was going on with Venezuela, to force them and or compel them or incentivize them into working with us in a number of areas. Now, some of those areas were things like oil, and that's become a big, big part of what we deal with them. More recently, our Department of the Interior was in Venezuela, and we cut a big deal on gold, and I think we're looking at Venezuela as a place to get resources from. Oil, natural gas, probably gold, other minerals, things along that line. That's kind of what we're looking at them for. So basically fashion agreements. And I think that's the same thing we're going to do with Cuba is, but we may not even have to do anything militarily to intervene in Cuba. We may just be able to use our position and the threat of what we could do as enough to basically cut a deal, for lack of a better term, with Cuba. And certainly President Trump leaves the option open in his language of, could there be military intervention? And he's kind of like, well, maybe. And he leaves that sort of open. So there's, you know, certainly there's the threat of military involvement by the U.S. and talking about it as the next thing that we do after we take care of Iran. So obviously Cuba is very, very nervous about that. Frankly, Cuba is desperate. Their economy's in tatters. The regime needs a lifeline. And Donald Trump loves to negotiate, especially when he feels that he can leverage what he has to get a really good deal. And that's what he's pretty much doing. Okay, that's enough on Cuba. The other big news this week is the new Shield of the Americas. On Saturday, March 7th, President Trump was down in Miami, and he announced a new coalition to counter drug trafficking cartels, and he inaugurated this thing called Shield of the Americas. And his former DHS Secretary, Kristi Noem, is the envoy for the Shield of the Americas. Although, at one point, the questions became so pointed that she actually got up and left the ceremony, very, very apparently to everybody there. She was not happy with the questions they were asking. And you can imagine after what just occurred that there were some questions that were pretty unpleasant for her. What President Trump said is, on this historic day, we come together to announce a brand new military coalition to eradicate the criminal cartels plaguing our region. And then he convened these Latin American leaders and members of his administration, among others. I should mention there was quite a collection of South American, Central American, Caribbean leaders. Argentina and Chile were there. Bolivia, Costa Rica, Ecuador, El Salvador, Guyana, Honduras, Panama, Paraguay, Trinidad and Tobago, the Dominican Republic, all of these. If you're familiar with what the cartels are doing, if you're familiar with what's going on in South America, if you're familiar with what's going on in Central America and the Caribbean, that is a impressive collection. Now, there are some noticeable countries that were absent as well, and maybe they will come in later, and Colombia being probably one of the ones I look at most closely. But it is pretty impressive. And basically, it's a counter-cartel coalition. And when President Trump was asked, he said it has to do mostly with drugs, largely. So that's what it's focused on. Of course, we have designated the cartels as terrorist groups. And based on that when we see cartel movements in the water, we will address it kinetically, like we would if we saw terrorists moving things. And we have defined the drugs in terms of how many people they could kill. So the drugs have been somewhat redefined as weapons of mass destruction. And in that, we have justified why our use of force in this regard. Now, he also, in that same ceremony in Miami, addressed the ouster of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in January and calling it 18 minutes of pure violence. I think what he was doing was just reminding everybody there of what the U.S. is capable of. He commended Delcy Rodriguez of Venezuela, the interim leader down there, for working with us. And he says she's doing a great job, which I always find kind of interesting. He has a certain turn of phrase on that. And he says, and if she wasn't working with us, I would not say she's doing a great job. So he pretty much made it clear that her cooperation was pretty much connected to his assessment of how she's doing. And that he's added that U.S. companies are taking out a tremendous amount of oil from Venezuela, which is true. They are taking a lot, although Venezuela's oil production is so far down from where it was before Chavez took over. I think it was like close to 3.5 million barrels a day when he took over, and now it's less than 500 million barrels a day. So that's, 500,000 barrels a day. So that's a significant reduction, and the U.S. companies would have to go in there with a massive investment and effort in order to bring it back up to its pre-Chavez production levels. But as to paraphrase the CEO of ExxonMobil, right now Venezuela is uninvestable. So a lot of things would have to happen for that investment to take place. What's clear is that President Trump is not an ideological, pure democracy purist. All right. He'll work with other countries. He'll work with other country leaders to further his goals and to further the U.S. goals. In many ways, this is kind of a throwback, if you will, to U.S. Relations that we had with South American, Central American countries going back to, well, back to the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, where certainly the pre-Jimmy Carter era, where we would simply work with countries if they would work with us. And, you know, as I believe it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt was talking about Somoza of Nicaragua, you know, the deposed dictator there, that he says he's an SOB, I'm paraphrasing, but he's RSOB. And that's kind of how the U.S. did things in realpolitik, geopolitik for a long time. And then in the mid-70s, we kind of took on this purist thing. Now, I'm not saying that's not a bad thing. I'm not saying that there was some really good things that came out of that. But one of the worst things that came out of it was what happened when we went in and took out Saddam Hussein. And we decided we're going to, you know, de-bathicize Iraqi society. And we stood down not only the, Republican Guard, but we also stood down the military as a whole. We stood down large chunks of police forces. And we left the country without any public safety institutions. Needless to say, the country swiftly devolved into anarchy, which then festered into a insurgency movement that we had to deal with for the next 2+ decades dealing with that. And that's the aftermath of trying to do what probably at the time, if you were to sit there and you were having coffee in some coffee house in Washington, D.C. and said, oh, we need to get rid of these evil Baathists because they're really bad, you know, and we did. Well, that's the effects of that. And I would point out the Nazis were extremely bad, but Patton took a little bit of heat because when he went in and was basically overseeing a large chunk of German territory at the end of World War II, he put some folks back in charge of running things that used to be Nazis. And basically his thinking was, yeah, but they know how to make the trains run on time, in so many words. And so that was his thing. Doesn't take away from how horrific the Nazis were, but he was very practical. He said, look, keep the country going. Keep the socioeconomic system intact. Otherwise, you know, if you don't have it intact, it can open up far worse consequences, would be kind of the thinking there. So that seems to be some of the thinking that permeates why we're working with some of these leaders that we, you know, in any other way wouldn't be particularly positive about working with any other way. So anyway, we're going after these drug cartels. Not to oversimplify it, but Donald Trump definitely projects overt machismo, something that would resonate in a lot of Latin American countries. So I think that kind of helps them feel a little bit of confidence in working with them because there's something there culturally that kind of resonates with what they see, what they perceive as a trait of strength. And they don't see the U.S. doing what we've kind of done in the past. You know, we declare a war on drugs, but we never really put all the resources and efforts into it that one would expect of a genuine war. And at times our war on drugs, you know, diverts into programs with demand reduction. No matter how, you know, good those demand reduction programs are, again, in a Latin American context, it's like, that's great, you're addressing this problem, but I'm just not seeing it. So if I'm a Latin American leader and I want to take great political risk by aligning myself with the U.S. too strongly or very strongly on this issue, I would be a little reticent in past administrations to do so because I wasn't quite sure if they, quote, had my back. And in this case, I think what they see with this administration is that they're serious. I mean, they're looking at the U.S. using kinetic strike missions to blow up narco cartel trafficking go-fast boats and semi-submersibles in the water. That's just something we just never did before. And so to some, I think they see that as a measure of commitment. All right. Now, I'd also remind folks that we not only have the oil coming out of Venezuela, but we just cut a deal with our Secretary of Interior down in Caracas, where we're going to get a lot of gold and other, potentially beyond that, other types of mineral wealth that comes from Venezuela. And also, don't forget, you know, what took place in the first half of the year and is still kind of finishing up, well, basically took place over 2025 with Panama, and we threatened to militarily retake the Panama Canal Zone, and this ended up with Panama, you know, going up through all the way through the Supreme Court to boot out the Hong Kong-based company that owned two huge port complexes on each end of the canal and turning that over to a U.S.-involved Western ownership of these port complexes. And it's just amazing to see this transition took place. At the end of the day, by doing what the U.S. asked them to do, there was no military invasion or anything like that in Panama. They worked out a deal. If you look at China as our near-peer competitor, if you look at China as the great threat to the United States, and you start seeing what we're doing in, obviously, Latin America and the Western Hemisphere, look at kind of what we're doing with Iran, a lot of things will come to focus. You know, a lot of things in the Cold War, which in the microcosm of the U.S. and, say, a particular country, whether that's Vietnam or somewhere else, didn't seem to make a lot of sense. But if you put it in the larger context of the Cold War dynamic and our confrontation with the Soviet Union, things started to make a little bit more sense in terms of what we're doing, particularly as we're avoiding, you know, the consequences of an all-out nuclear war. So anyway, I just find this kind of interesting. I think we're kind of doing, in many ways, the same thing with China that we were doing with the Soviet Union back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. And then, of course, at the end of the day, the Soviet Union collapsed. And I am one of those who thinks that China's economic model has some very, very deep flaws. And they, too, will have a massive correction one of these days. So what does this mean? Well, this means that the U.S. is very serious about controlling the Western Hemisphere and dealing with the biggest threats that those respective governments are trying to work with, which is the cartels and the gangs associated with the cartels, and trying to work deals in the Western Hemisphere that obviously benefit the U.S. directly, but also offset the investment that we make in security in the Western Hemisphere as well and dealing with these cartels. So it's a little bit of transactional, and I'll be the first to admit that that is part of it, clearly. And it's also making sure that China cannot control key economic sectors and countries in our own backyard. Frankly, China was doing that. China has been moving in big into South America, big into Central America. They have been securing key mineral rights. They have been securing a lot of things in these countries. And now you're seeing the U.S. really start to push back in a very forceful way. I think what we just saw happen in Miami with this Shield of the Americas, obviously not naming China by name, but basically in so many words, pushing to do this. And when I see Argentina and Chile in that and Bolivia, I look at the Altiplano. I look at, even though we say drill, baby, drill with oil, lithium is still a major commodity on the global trade, and in doing this, we have brought together a coalition that just happens to control all those Altiplano lithium deposits, which are so critical for renewable energy. So, just kind of an interesting side note I want to throw out there. Hey, thanks for listening to Strat. Also, please visit stratpodcast.com. And you can also go to my YouTube channel, Hal Kempfer TV, or go to my corporate website, www.gripsa.com. And if you're interested in hearing what I have to say about the entire globe, you can go to the Los Angeles InfraGuard website at www.infraguard.org. InfraGuardLosAngeles.org, InfraGuard Los Angeles, all one word. And on March 18th, I am doing a 2.5-hour global threat update where I'm going to look at not just the Western Hemisphere, not just the Middle East, but look all around the globe at a variety of things from a military, political, and economic perspective as to how we are, you know, what is happening in the world and how we're dealing with it. So hopefully, if you get a chance, you can sign up for that as well. Thanks again for listening, and hope to hear you or see you again, or hope to have you listening to the next Strat.